Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Mexico, a little bit about Mexican politics, and about the relationship between Mexico and the United States. And our guest for the program is Gordon Hansen. He is a professor of economics in the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies and in the Department of Economics at University of California, San Diego. He's particularly interested in the economic consequences of Mexican migration to the United States, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk with Professor Hansen, questions, comments certainly are welcome. All we ask of callers is people just trying to be brief so that we can get in as many as possible and keep the program moving, but of course anybody who is listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Hansen, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. We now are approaching, or I'd say we in Mexico, they're approaching another presidential election. There'll be elections next year. President Fox, Vicente Fox, was first elected in the summer of 2000. And in Mexico, the term of the president is 6 years, and one can only serve one term, so he can't run again. And one of the things I thought I would like to start out with is to talk a little bit about Vicente Fox and the fact that when he became president, I think a lot of people said he was a revolutionary. This was something of a revolution in large part because it was the first time that the longtime ruling party had lost, but also perhaps because they thought that Vicente Fox had some ideas and that would be revolutionary. Now, this many years later, say a little more than five years after he was elected, what can you say about Vicente Fox and whether indeed he has turned out to be a revolutionary or not?
Well, I think in a lot of people's minds, President Fox's greatest accomplishment was getting elected in the first place, and that he achieved in breaking a string of 70 years of rule by a single party. And he helped put an end to an authoritarian pattern in Mexican politics. Now, so that accomplishment in and of itself is something that will ensure him a prominent place in Mexican history. But then to expect to cap that off with a major process of reform is and has proven to be extremely difficult. Mexico has now found itself as a functioning democracy where one party doesn't control all branches of government. And what that's meant is that we've seen the messy politics that's characteristic of democracies with lots of fighting and not very much progress on the legislative front.
Hmm. Well, that's I guess that raises the question about would some people in Mexico be prepared to make the argument that when the PRI was the dominant party that somehow things were better?
Well, the PRI got things done. The problem was that, so depending on who was in power and what the agenda was, that could be a good thing or that could be a bad thing. But ultimately, there was the methods that the PRI used to keep itself in power in terms of using electoral fraud, in terms of buying off key interest groups to keep them from joining the political opposition, were corrosive. They prevented Mexico from developing political institutions that you expect to see in an economy, in a country that's vibrant, an economy that is capable of growing, an economy in a country that represents the interests of its citizens. And so, one must say that the PRI achieved certain successes in helping modernize Mexico. In a sense, its time had come to an end, and it was time for Mexico to make that difficult transition from single-party rule to democratic rule.
The PRI apparently has made a little bit of a comeback. At least there have been some stories recently about two wins that the PRI has had maybe one more significant than the other, which was winning the governor's position in one of the states of Mexico. This doesn't, however, suggest that the PRI is likely, or does it suggest that the PRI is likely ever to have the kind of political power that it did?
In the near term, it's unlikely that the PRI will have the sort of power that it had in the past. In part, that's because Congress in Mexico is divided between three parties. And this was President Fox's problem. His party did not have a majority in Congress. And so he needed to work with lawmakers from other parties in order to foster coalitions to help get bills passed. Now, Mexico doesn't have any tradition of this sort of legislative coalition building, something that has been standard for a long time in the United States and many other countries. And President Fox, who was a skilled campaigner, didn't seem to be particularly skilled in the craftsmanship of politics, something that Lyndon B. Johnson was exceptionally good at, something that Ronald Reagan was exceptionally good at, in terms of getting Congress to agree to pass different items of legislation. So what we've seen the PRI do is make a comeback, be very focused on trying to win the next presidential election coming up in 2006. However, even if it wins, it's going to end up without a majority of seats in the Congress, and it's going to have a similar problem that President Fox did.
Well, now we're now at the point where there. Can you imagine anyone having a majority? Is it always going to be the case that there's going to have to be coalition building and cooperation going on between interests that might, in some sense, be competing?
Well, the fact that we have three parties in Mexico who are all staking a claim to the presidency and control of the Congress, I think, is testimony to the political divisions that exist within the country. Mexico, like much of Latin America, is a country of extremes of wealth. The wealthy in Mexico are as wealthy as any group of rich business people in the world, and the poor in Mexico are destitute. Those extremes are reflected in politics, with groups that are staunchly conservative, groups that tend much more towards the left, and sort of a muddled center. So for the time being, we've got parties that are trying to figure out where in that fractious political environment do you stake your claim. I think in the long run, three important parties is not a stable situation, and that we're going to ultimately see the parties break apart and new coalitions form and the emergence of two dominant groups, at least as long as Mexico keeps its current system of government. But in the medium run, what we've got is three parties, none of which is capable of having control over the political system. And so there's going to be a need for horse trading. There's going to be a need for coalition building. That slows things down. But what's good about it is that it helps the country develop those democratic institutions that one needs in order to ensure that everyone's interests are represented.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Gordon Hanson. He's an economist, professor of economics in the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at University of California, San Diego. We're talking about Mexico. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, having said what you have about Mr. Fox, about President Fox, can one point to some things that where you would think his administration has been a success, or something that they would point to as a success?
I think there are a couple important accomplishments that the Fox administration has achieved. One is the passage of what's known as the equivalent of our Freedom of Information Act in the United States, known as the Transparency Law in Mexico. And this allows public citizens to request information about how money is spent in Mexico. This information has never been available before. And what it's meant is that the public has been able to hold elected officials accountable. because they're able to see exactly how much money they have at their disposal and what they do with it. And it's caused numerous minor scandals when it's been discovered that politicians have been living very lavishly or devoting spending on relatives and pet projects that would have very little public support. And that's been an important transformation in Mexico. Now politicians are under threat of having what corrupt practices of the past exposed. A second important thing that's happened in Mexico is that the Fox administration has helped build a strong civil service. That is a system of governmental administration that's not based purely on political appointees. It's based on a long-term qualified group of government officials who see their career as being in government and not as serving a particular party.
One of the things that I was interested in having you talk a little bit about as we look ahead to the presidential elections next year is the case of the mayor of Mexico City, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and his popularity, his chances of being elected president, and also what the political establishment has done, what some people would argue what the political establishment has done to sideline him or to attempt to sideline him.
So the story of López Obrador is very interesting, and it's telling about different paths that Mexico might take politically in the future. He is somebody who is a politician of the left, but what is unknown is how far to the left. Some like to characterize him as similar to President Lula in Brazil, somebody who has definitely pursued social welfare policies to try and redistribute some income to the poor, but who's also pursued sound fiscal policies and been a relatively efficient manager, some recent troubles notwithstanding. Other folks who are more alarmist like to say, no, what López Obrador is going to do is try and recreate what Hugo Chávez is doing in Venezuela, which is to bring the state back in to control the reins of the economy in Mexico. So those people painting those scenarios are sort of indicative of a political tension that exists in Mexico. There is a sense in which the ruling party, which characterized itself as representing, coming out of the Mexican Revolution and representing the poor in Mexico, never did represent the poor in Mexico. They represented the elites. And now the possibility of a truly populist politician coming to power really scares some people. And what they've been willing to do is engage in dirty tricks to try and prevent that from coming about.
Well, this case, and I've read about it, and I guess I'm not sure that I completely understand what happened, has to do with the fact that they were building a road to a hospital, and somebody who owned the land nearby got a court order saying that the construction should be halted, but Mr. López Obrador went ahead and said, no, we're going to build this road, for which he received a great deal of popular support. Then it looked like, in fact, he maybe wouldn't be able to run because he would either was charged with a crime or he might actually be on trial at the time. And that caused so much trouble that was set aside for the moment. And I guess I'm not quite sure I'm completely up to speed on this and whether that was completely set aside or whether the government just sort of said, well, we'll deal with that later. So that he's still able to run, and in a sense that mollified all those people that were particularly his constituents that were so angry about what had happened. Where exactly does this story stand now?
It's more or less resolved. The details are that as mayor, López Obrador was continuing a public works project that had been started by his predecessor, which involved the state using its right of eminent domain to take up a piece of private property to build an access road to up to a public hospital. There was a lawsuit against that and an injunction against the taking of the land, and there was some dispute about that. And it was a minor skirmish in which López Obrador may have committed a very minor infraction, but one which would have been easily resolved in court. But rather than allowing it to be easily resolved in court as a civil matter, a dispute between a private property owner and the government, the Fox administration tried to turn it into a criminal matter in order to bar Lopez Obrador from running for president.
And was it very? Obviously, that's the way a lot of people in Mexico saw it. They said that it was a transparent attempt to make sure that he would not be able to run. Is that basically that's how everybody saw it? And it was, in fact, that, do you think that's what it was?
I think it's a pretty accurate representation. There was a certain amount of horse trading going on in the background, in that the ruling party, the former ruling party, the PRI, and President Fox's party, the PAN, essentially agreed to form a coalition to take out the leftist mayor of Mexico City and prevent him from being a candidate, so that the two of them, the PAN and the PRI, could fight it out in the next presidential election. That sort of backroom deal has been very common in Mexico in the past. And in the past, politicians have been able to get away with it. And what was surprising is that President Fox, somebody who's supposedly representing the democratic ideals of the New Mexico, was willing to engage in those sorts of dirty tricks. Now, by all accounts, he wasn't the strategy they were using wasn't his idea. It was some of his political underlings who have presidential ambitions of their own. But still, he was willing to sign off on it, at least for a while.
So certainly it wouldn't have benefited him because he can't run again, but it might have benefited his party if they were interested, and as I'm sure that they are, in continuing to hold the position of the president.
Sure, and he was also concerned about his legacy, were he to pass off the presidency to what his party members, what Mexico would see as a dangerous leftist. I think he himself would have seen his legacy as tarnished. But in the end, the popular reaction to this was so strong and so unexpected that President Fox had to back down. And that act also has made people nervous, because what it's perhaps a sign of is a populism in Mexico, which hasn't been seen for many decades, reasserting itself and playing an important role in politics. And as in any environment, populism can be very unpredictable in terms of the sort of leaders it pushes forward.
Well, that, I suppose, in my mind raises a question to what extent this was an indication of support for the Democratic Revolutionary Party and Mr. Lopez Obrador, or maybe some of it was just this feeling that what the PAN and the president were doing was just simply wrong, unfair, not playing by the rules, and that it was people feeling that the PAN was simply overreaching. Was it that, or was it people who genuinely felt supportive of Mr. Lopez Obrador?
Well, I think it was a little of both, but one thing to keep in mind is all of this played out in Mexico City, which is where Lopez Obrador has his political, most of his political support. His party, the leftist party, the PRD, is not truly a national party. They have strong representation in a number of important states in Mexico. They don't have very strong representation in many states in the north and a number of states in the center of the country. Because this happened in Mexico City, where there are so many supporters of the mayor, he was able to get people out into the streets. And added on top of that was the dissatisfaction with the old style dirty tricks making a reappearance in Mexican politics.
Well, given that his strength is mostly in Mexico City, where he's the mayor, is he a viable national candidate?
At this point, we don't know. He's doing well in the polling. But as we all know, polling a year ahead of elections isn't terribly meaningful. There's another wild card that's going to be thrown into the 2006 election, and that is the vote by Mexican immigrants in the United States, which has recently been made possible by absentee ballot. And this is another thing, another accomplishment of the Fox administration, helping push that through, which, again, broadens the Democratic base in Mexico. Nobody knows what fraction of Mexican immigrants in the United States will vote in the Mexican election, although their political leanings don't seem to be all that different from Mexico as a whole.
Well, this I'm glad you touched on that, because it was one of the things that I wanted to ask about, and indeed the question being how much difference might this make, that we're talking about, you know, it's estimated that something like 11 million Mexicans in the United States, but how many of them will vote and for whom they would vote does, as I say, raise the question in my mind, how much difference does that make? And could this make or break the election in Mexico for one candidate or another?
Well, it will certainly matter for outcomes in specific states, because the immigrant community from Mexico in the United States tends to about a little over 50% of the individuals of Mexican immigrants in the U.S. come from about 9 states in Mexico. Even though Mexican immigrants in the U.S. as a whole are only about 10% of Mexico's population, are a much higher fraction of the population in a number of populous states in Mexico's west. And so the immigrant vote in those states could be decisive in determining who wins seats in Congress, who becomes governor, what the political composition of those states look like. Now, when it comes to the presidency, I think the vote abroad probably works against the PRD, the leftist party of Mexico City's mayor López Obrador, just because that's a party without sort of your standard organizational infrastructure that the other parties have, making it harder for them to campaign not only nationally but then also certainly campaigning in the United States.
We are at our midpoint in this part of Focus 580, and let me again introduce our guest. We're talking with Gordon Hansen. He's professor of economics in the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies, also in the Department of Economics at University of California, San Diego. We're talking about Mexico, and if questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. 800-222-9455. Apparently, the Interior Minister of Mexico, Santiago Creel, has said that he would be interested in representing his party, the PAN, Mr. Fox's party, as the presidential candidate next year. I don't know. Perhaps there may be some others. Do you think it's likely that this is the man who is going to be the PAN's presidential candidate?
At this point, he's the front runner at this point. But the three candidates from the PAN who put themselves forward, none of them have inspired much in the way of political outpouring. None of them look like particularly strong candidates. And then from the PRI, you have a man in the name of Roberto Madrazo, who is currently the head of the PRI, who has a troubled past. He's been associated with corruption scandals in an election to become governor of the state of Tabasco in Mexico, and is seen as sort of representing old-style authoritarian tactics within the PRI. So if you look at any of the presidential hopefuls for the upcoming election, all have their flaws, which suggests that it's going to be a very hard-fought campaign. And it's going to be a campaign in which tactics and in which money play a very important role.
Well, we have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. First, someone listening over in Indiana, and we'll go there first, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Two questions, which I think are similar. First one is, has the Bush administration made its feelings known to the Mexican authorities or leaders about what they want? And secondly, if they were to try to do something to hurt this fellow who's a populist candidate, what procedures might they use? And if so, have they already done that, or do you see anything on the Verizon that they're going to do that. My guess would be that they didn't want to, would not want a populist leader of Mexico, you know, just simply because of the oil interest there, as far as that goes. Thanks a lot.
I think it's a very interesting question. I think you're absolutely right that the Bush administration would not like to see a populist president of Mexico. At the same time, the one thing that would probably guarantee that López Obrador wins the presidency of Mexico is for the U.S. to come out against him publicly. In Mexico, there is tremendous sensitivity about U.S. meddling in Mexico's political system and in Mexico's economy. And so I think that at this point, the Bush administration is correctly keeping things pretty quiet on the public front. I'm sure there's lots going on behind the scenes in terms of strategizing about how to help one candidate or another, but there will be very little that happens publicly because that would almost undoubtedly backfire. We've seen that an example of that, of a support for political opposition backfiring in the case of Venezuela, where the Bush administration's actions to help the opposition to Hugo Chavez have actually helped Chavez strengthen his position in the country and take an even more aggressive role in bringing state control over the economy and politically repressing his those who oppose him.
Hmm. Well, obviously, as you say, the Bush administration wouldn't want to be seen as actively working against Mr. López Obrador, but it's, I suppose it's possible that if they could find something to boost Mr. Fox and his party, the PAN, that that might be good, that might be seen as good for them. Is there anything that the administration can do in the next year that might have an effect like that?
Well, the big issue is immigration reform. Mm-hmm. This was the promise on which President Fox really staked his presidency. He trusted that his close personal friendship with President Bush and would help lead to meaningful reform of immigration policies in the United States, which would be seen very positively in Mexico, increasing Fox's standing at home. Now, what happened was those policies, Bush's proposals for immigration reform were all put on hold after the events of September 11th in 2001. And what we've seen since then is the Bush administration tentatively suggests that it might think about putting immigration reform proposals back on the table. But now what we have is Social Security reform taking precedence, possibly tax reform taking precedence, and certainly the upcoming battle over the Supreme Court justice nomination drawing the energies from the Bush administration away from thinking about policies which might affect Mexican politics.
Mm. That's one of the things that I know that you're particularly interested in and have done a lot of writing on and research on, and I wanted to make sure that we get to. And President Bush apparently said at the beginning of last year that this was something that he wanted to, that his immigration reform was something that he wanted to work on. And then, of course, we know that he had dedicated an awful lot of his personal time to the issue of Social Security and spent a lot of time talking about that. There apparently are some people in Congress who are interested in the subject and in advancing some kind of legislation to do what the president, President Bush and President Fox have both talked about, is create what would in effect be a kind of a guest worker program for the United States. Although, again, as you say, there are so many other issues on the table, so many other subjects that I think some people in Washington don't really expect that much of anything this year would happen on that issue. So you pretty much see that's it's something that's on the agenda for discussion, but as far as action is concerned, you wouldn't expect anything to happen anytime soon.
If you want to clear a room full of politicians, all you need to do is mention the words immigration reform. Nobody wants to get close to this issue politically because it is so it is such a politically divisive issue. The Republican Party is divided about immigration policy. The Democratic Party is divided about immigration policy. Even environmental groups are divided about immigration policy. Now, the two central issues that must be dealt with are, what do we do about a population of illegal immigrants in the United States, which is about 11 million people today? And two, how do we meaningfully reform enforcement policies? In particular, how do we penalize employers that hire illegal immigrants? Dealing with either issue draws political fire from one or both sides of the political spectrum, and at this point, very few people are willing to stand up and put their name on a bill that would really substantially change the way that U.S. deals with immigration.
Let's talk with someone else. The next caller up here is in Chicago, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. My question has to do with immigration, since you're in the area of economics. I was wanted to ask about the relationship between immigration and the American banking system. I recall back in the 1970s and 80s, American banks had made huge loans to Mexico and other Latin American countries and were in serious trouble because of the economies down there. We're not able to repay these loans, and I imagine these loans are still outstanding. And it would seem to me that, from what I understand, just as regard to Mexico, from my understanding is that the currency which is sent back from the immigrants in this country to Mexico is the second largest source of revenue for Mexico after oil. It's even greater than tourism, from what I've learned. And so what I'm asking is if, we didn't have these immigrants here, American banks would be in serious trouble. Some of these large American banks, which were in serious trouble before this wave of immigration, would be in very serious trouble today and would probably present a crisis to the American economy in the sense of a deflationary effect, a depression, if these banks were to collapse, or the American taxpayer would have to, bail them out like they bailed out other corporations. And I'm just wondering, is that your understanding of the situation?
Well, the issue of immigration from Mexico and Mexican banking and banks in the United States is a very interesting one. It is true that in the past, Mexico had amassed large debts to foreign banks and U.S. banks in particular. But Mexico, over the last 15 years or so, over the last 10 years in particular, has been able to deal with those debts pretty successfully. Today, Mexico is viewed as a pretty good credit risk. Now, part of the way it's been able to do that is by having very strong growth in its exports. And as you mentioned, one important source of that growth has come from income that Mexican immigrants earn in the United States and send back to their family members in Mexico. Now, where U.S. banks come in is U.S. banks have realized that the Mexican immigrant community in the United States and the money they send home is a growth opportunity. And U.S. banks have been very aggressive about trying to bring Mexican immigrants into the banking sector. And what's interesting about this is that these immigrants come from families in Mexico who do not participate in the banking system. So it's through the process of immigration and through their connection with U.S. banks that we've got a whole segment of Mexican society that's really operated outside of the formal financial system, which has been brought into that system, which is helping generate extra savings and channeling that savings into investment and helping both economies grow.
Well, what I was going to ask was if you were, like many people are proposing, to send back the immigrants, and to me that would create a crisis in the financial sector in a sense where, Mexico's economy would be in danger of collapsing if this were to happen. And also in that sense, with the outstanding loans which they have to American banks, that would have a ripple effect on our economy. Would that be correct to say?
I'm not one who would advocate sending 11 million immigrants home.
Right, I understand it.
But I think you're right that would have devastating consequences for the Mexican economy. Mexico depends on the income that workers in the United States generate for the country, and a large return migration from the United States would be devastating for the economy. But an important thing to keep in mind, it would also be devastating, not for the U.S. economy as a whole so much, where the effects would be important, but not huge. But it would matter tremendously for certain regions in the United States that have come to depend upon immigrant labor to keep industries alive. Now, that used to be just agriculture in California and Texas, but now it includes meatpacking in Iowa and poultry processing in Arkansas and construction in Georgia and North Carolina and tourist industries in Florida. All of those industries depend on immigrant labor and would be hurt tremendously by the loss of access to that labor.
Could I ask one other question?
Yeah, if you can be quick. Sure.
Oh, sure. With regards to the influence on our pension system, you know, with the baby boomer generation coming to retirement and the low reproduction rates in this country, the small families in this country, isn't it true that we do really need a large immigrant population in this country to support the future of the pension system, such as Social Security? And without this immigrant population, you would have a problem with Social Security down the line.
Well, the adding immigrants to the population does help you deal with a pension crisis. The U.S. situation isn't nearly as dire as it is in Japan or Europe, where the baby bust that followed their baby booms has meant that there are just not going to be enough workers to support those in retirement in the coming years. In the United States, the situation isn't quite as drastic. The U.S. could solve its problem with Social Security with relatively minor changes in Social Security taxes and Social Security benefits. Now, immigration could help on the margin, but one thing to keep in mind is that many of the immigrants coming in are immigrants who earn pretty low incomes, and so their net contribution to the U.S. tax system isn't all that large. Once you look at the tax contributions they make and then net out the spending that goes for public education and all this other stuff, that group ends up being a net drain on U.S. governmental resources. So as a solution, if you want to use immigration to solve the Social Security problem, you have to bring in high-income, high-skilled immigrants to do that in relatively large numbers.
How important to the Mexican economy is the money that Mexicans working in the United States send back home?
So for Mexico's economy overall, that money that flows from the U.S. back to Mexico is close to 3% of Mexico's gross domestic product. So 3% of Mexico's national income comes from earnings from Mexican immigrants in the United States. Now, when you look at specific states in Mexico, that number is considerably higher. It's closer to 20%. So in their whole regions of Mexico, where one of the major sources of income is money that family members in the United States send home.
Let's talk with someone else. Watsika is the next caller, line 4.
My question has to do with the corruption in Mexico. First of all, how corrupt exactly is the government and the political parties out there? Specifically, how much does drug money affect the political process down there? And also, I want to know about the various agencies and armed forms of government down there, the insurgents, the legitimate and illegitimate ones, the army, the federales. Who are they aligned with politically, and to what extent are they controlled by, say, local powers that be either legitimate or illegitimate? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's a very important corruption and the role of the military and the police in national life are very important issues in Mexico today. You know, corruption in Mexico is an unfortunate fact of life. It's something that's been around for a long time. But I think, you know, as the caller suggests, you want to distinguish between the type of corruption that's associated with drug money, which is relatively recent, and the type of corruption that's the everyday part of life in a country that is whose democratic institutions are still developing. What drug money has done in Mexico is bring a major new source of resources to bear to try and buy access to the U.S. market. Mexico is a distribution point for cocaine that's produced in Colombia and that's sent to the United States. And there are a series of cartels in Mexico which handle distribution at several points along the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, those cartels have paid off politicians, they've paid off police, they've paid off the military in order to be able to do their thing, to move drugs through Mexico into the United States. But that corruption is doesn't reach into every aspect of life necessarily, because what you want as a drug runner is to get your drugs through. You don't necessarily care who the governor is or what policies he's following on education or social welfare or labor rights or whatever. What you care about is, will he let your planes land on airstrips in the state and get your drugs through? So while corruption has had very important impacts on the police and the military, I don't know that it's really corrupted the country's political institutions. Now, that said, the fact that Mexico's police and armed forces are less trustworthy than they once were is a tremendous issue of concern for the country.
All right. Nobody gets at the question of the caller. We have someone else here. Urbana next, line two. Hello.
I was wondering if you happen to know anything about, I've heard two or three Social Security Administration people refer to billions and hundreds of billions of dollars accumulated over the last two or three decades, I guess it is, that due to illegal immigrants paying Social Security under false Social Security numbers, and then, of course, not claiming any kind of benefit at the end of their time here. I was wondering if, because you talked earlier about how there's a net negative financial effect to the illegal immigrants coming to this country because of the low wages as far as Social Security is concerned, but did you include that?
So the Social Security contributions is a very interesting story. So what happens is, since changes in U.S. immigration law in the 1980s, U.S. employers are required to ask to see valid identification from all workers who apply for a job. So what illegal immigrants will do is present a counterfeit Social Security card and a counterfeit green card to show that they're eligible to work, and U.S. employers oftentimes may know that these things are counterfeit, just accept them at face value. The law doesn't require them to do anything more than to note the information on these documents. Now, what the employers then do is to withhold Social Security taxes from these workers' paychecks and send that money to the Social Security Administration. Now, since these Social Security cards are counterfeit, the numbers are fictitious. They don't belong to any real account. And that money goes into something called the earnings suspense file in the Social Security Administration. Now, right now, that account has somewhere over $400 billion in it. We don't know how much of that is due to contributions of illegal immigrants. Undoubtedly, a large amount of it does have to do with contributions from illegal immigrants. So in the statement I made earlier about immigrants, both legal and illegal from Mexico, having a net drain on U.S. fiscal resources, I was taking into account our best estimates of what those contributions look like. It's absolutely correct that many illegal immigrants do make contributions to the U.S. Social Security system on which they will never collect. I should also add that many illegal immigrants pay income taxes. Now, you might ask, why would you do that? Well, by virtue of getting a tax identification number from the United States, it makes it easier to get loans from banks. It makes it easier to participate in the economy in a variety of different areas, and it also kind of builds your case for ultimately becoming a legal immigrant. So it's not true, as many folks say, that illegal immigrants don't pay taxes. They do, the drain that comes from the usage of public education and the usage of health care makes a lot.
Oh, shit! God damn it!
Hello.
Yeah, I'm not quite exactly sure what happened there to the caller. You're still there, right, Mr.
Yes.
Hansen? Okay. Go ahead.
We have that tax revenue coming in Social Security and income taxes, as well as, you know, sales taxes and property taxes from illegal immigrants. but we also have expenditure going out to them from uses of public education, from emergency medical services, and other areas. And sort of the best guess is that on net, illegal immigrants are a net drain on the fiscal resources of the U.S. economy. Now, you got to balance that against the economic contributions they make by bringing their labor here. And when you put all of that together, what you come up with is a net contribution to the U.S. economy, which could be positive, could be negative. It's in either case, it's not a large share of U.S. GDP. It's going to be less than a 20th of a percent of U.S. GDP.
Well, one of the things that I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about it, getting back to this idea of the kind of immigration reforms that the president has talked about, and there may be some support among some members of Congress for, that is making it possible for people who either are now here illegally to be here legally and work, or for people who would want to come here to the United States for a period of time to come here legally and work. Who benefits from that?
Well, two groups in particular. Employers benefit because they get access to more labor at the same wage or more labor at lower wages. Now, that's not all employers. It's employers in industries that use low-wage labor. So that's going to be in apparel industry and meatpacking and poultry processing and food processing in manufacturing industries. It's going to include service industries and restaurants and hotels, construction, as well as the provision of janitors and security personnel and house cleaning services and so forth. The other group that benefits are consumers that buy those goods. Now that again, that's not everybody, and it's not everybody in all parts of the country. But they benefit by getting access to those goods and services at lower prices than they would otherwise.
Hmm. And when you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that immigration reform is one of those issues that for a lot of members in Congress, nobody wants to. It's another one of those third rail issues that nobody wants to go near. What is it that makes it so difficult makes members of Congress so hesitant to even want to talk about it?
Well, I think because immigration policy divides the natural coalitions on which either the Republican Party is based or the Democratic Party is based. So within the Republican Party, when you talk about immigration reform, what you do is you create conflict between business interests, which would like to see access to more labor. You create conflict between them and fiscal conservatives, who are concerned about the public finance consequences of immigration. And then you're sort of social conservative law and order types who are concerned about what widespread illegal immigration means for U.S. civil society, for law and order in the country. On the Democratic side, you have a division between groups representing who are concerned about civil rights, groups who are representing Latinos in the United States, who are concerned that immigrants are treated fairly, with union workers who are concerned about immigration putting downward pressure on their wages. So even within the environmental community, you have folks that are concerned about immigration contributing to population growth and harming the environment versus those who want to maintain their alliance with civil rights groups that tend to support immigration. So you make you create enemies out of your friends when you bring up immigration policy.
Mm-hmm. So again, just to round out, you think probably not this year, maybe even not next year?
Well, there's a possibility in the coming year for a very modest type of immigration reform, which would be targeted on workers in the agricultural sector. Where there would be some sort of partial amnesty, that's an explosive term in immigration policy, but providing legal resident visas to workers who are in agriculture and expanding the number of temporary work visas for individuals in agriculture. There are several bills that are being debated in Congress right now that would achieve both those objectives. However, that is a very small piece of the larger immigration policy puzzle. And even if those bills go through, it's going to only make a small dent in that stock of 11 million illegal immigrants that are in the country, and it's not going to do anything to change meaningfully the nature of enforcement policies in the country.
Well, there we will have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest, Gordon Hanson, professor of economics in the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at University of California, San Diego. Professor Hanson, thanks very much.
It's been my pleasure.